From NPR News in New York, this is the Bryant Park Project.
Overlooking historic Bryant Park in Midtown Manhattan, live from the NPR studios, this is the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. I'm Allison Stewart. It's Thursday, March 20th, the first day of spring. And in terms of big news stories, yesterday in one of our meetings, we were thinking maybe this Hillary Clinton document dump would be the big story today. It would be what everybody was talking about. After all, 11,046 pages of her schedules of what went on in her life during her time during the White House were going to be released and everyone could read them and find out what happened. Would there be some concrete information regarding what she calls her experience during her time in the White House? Would we find out some interesting tidbits during some of those tumultuous times? Well, the documents came out early yesterday morning at about 11:28 a.m. This email went out to NPR from the newsroom. We're pouring through the 11,000 documents released about Senator Clinton's years as First Lady. It appears that the documents are exclusively her public schedules, which have always been public, just not in this form. Yeah, nothing that exciting in there. But she kind of looked at what wasn't in there. Some of the things that papers have been picking up on this morning, for example, where she was during the Monica Lewinsky time, sometimes actually in the White House. Or, for example, on May 19th, 1993, no mention at all in her public schedules or anything about the seven staffers who got fired as a part of that Travelgate. What you do find out is her life is so scripted. There's a weather forecast every day. We know that she got a gift basket on one day between 3:45 and 4:35. We also know when she was going to a hospital, literally, they wrote in this, quote, she will be escorted to a rocking chair by four patients who will sit next to her. Every part of her life, so detailed, so scripted, very much unlike the Bryant Park Project. On the show today, it's the vernal equinox, but it's also the great American meat out, the day when vegetarians try to grow the ranks. We'll get some tips for living that life in case you're thinking of converting. But don't worry, we have something for you carnivores as well, an interview with a former vegetarian who now edits a magazine called Meat Paper. Meat, meat, meat. That's what the magazine covers. Also, the New Yorker magazine, well, sometimes they can't fit all those very funny cartoons into their pages. So we get the leftovers. Matthew Diffie from the New Yorker will join us in the studio with another cartoonist. With their discards, we scoop them up and we present them to you. All that, plus the ramble, new movies, including something from the guys who brought you Knocked Up and Superbad. Daniel Holloway, our movie guy, will stop by. But first, the Midwest is underwater. At this hour, at least 13 people are dead, 3 people missing, and thousands are being evacuated as record flooding hits the Midwest. You should check back with NPR.org for updates. Continuous rainfall since Monday has dumped more than a foot of water in parts of the nation's midsection, leaving roads and homes underwater. And as rivers continue to rise, the worst may still be yet to come.
There's been some floods around here before, but it was worse than it's ever been. I mean, it was just unimaginable.
That was Kevin Ledicky, a resident of Piedmont, Missouri, one of the worst-hit areas. The record flooding there is being blamed for at least 5 deaths and caused the evacuation of more than 500 homes. President Bush declared Missouri a major disaster area last night, ordering federal funds to help recovery efforts. Flash flooding is expected to worsen in the coming days as rivers threaten to rise up to 2 more feet from the storm runoff. Missouri resident Michael Goforth says he was swept away by the rushing waters.
I was washed off a country road on Clark's Creek. Dropped off in a hole, and it washed my vehicle completely off the road.
Now, in Arkansas, 2 people are missing after their cars were swept away by rushing water as well. In Texas, a search is underway for a teen washed down a drainage pipe. The National Weather Service has issued flood warnings from Texas to Ohio, and the storm is now headed east to New England. For updates on the story throughout the day, head to NPR.org. Now, let's get some more of today's headlines.
This is NPR.
Thanks, Allison. Good morning, everyone. Osama bin Laden said yesterday that the European Union could face attacks after the republication of cartoons mocking the Islamic prophet Muhammad. Bin Laden delivered the warning in a recording released as Muslims celebrate Muhammad's birthday. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports from Cairo.
The audio recording marks the first time the al-Qaeda leader has been heard since last fall. It was posted on the internet by al-Qaeda's media arm, As-Sahab. Bin Laden's message was that the publication of controversial drawings was part of a new crusade against Islam. According to the tape, Bin Laden said, quote, "The answer will be what you shall see, not what you hear," which was seen as a threat of new attacks on European soil. The cartoons, which many Muslims took to be offensive, were first published by a Danish newspaper in 2005. They were reprinted the following year, sparking a widespread uproar and boycott campaign. This year, several Danish newspapers republished one of the cartoons again after a death threat against the cartoonist. Previous al-Qaeda attacks have hit Spain, Britain, Italy, and Denmark.
NPR's Peter Kenyon. Vice President Dick Cheney says the U.S. will ask NATO countries for more support in Afghanistan. Cheney spoke to reporters after meeting today with Afghan President Hamid Karzai in Kabul. NATO has about 43,000 troops on the ground already. Commanders are requesting an increase as fighting continues with al-Qaeda and Taliban militants in the southern part of Afghanistan. President Bush defended the war in Iraq Wednesday in a speech at the Pentagon. Yesterday marked the fifth anniversary of the U.S.-led invasion. The president said the war had cost more and been harder than expected, but he insisted the sacrifice has been worth it.
Because we acted, Saddam's torture chambers and rape rooms and children's prisons have been closed for good. Because we acted, Saddam's regime is no longer invading its neighbors or attacking them with chemical weapons and ballistic missiles. Because we acted, Saddam's regime is no longer paying the families of suicide bombers in the Holy Land. Because we acted, Saddam's regime is no longer shooting at American and British aircraft, patrolling the no-fly zones and defying the will of the United Nations. Because we acted, the world is better and the United States of America is safer.
Meanwhile, protesters across the United States marked the war's anniversary with a demand for immediate withdrawal of U.S. troops. In Chicago, thousands marched through the streets. Chip Mitchell of Chicago Public Radio reports.
The evening began with a rally in Federal Plaza.
Troops home now! Troops home now!
Speakers quoted former World Bank Vice President Joseph Stiglitz. He estimates that the war has cost the U.S. economy $3 trillion. And they accused U.S. leaders of exploiting idealistic soldiers. Christopher Arendt served as a Guantanamo Bay jailer during his 6 years in the Army National Guard.
We're destroying the minds and the lives of the young men and women who decide to serve this country because they think that it's the right thing to do.
Earlier in the day, a group convened outside Soldier Field to show a different type of support for U.S. troops in Iraq. An alderman there announced plans to push for a city memorial to honor soldiers fighting terrorism.
That was Chip Mitchell of Chicago Public Radio. And that's the news for now. It's always online at NPR.org.
This is NPR.
Thanks, Laura.
Thank you.
The word botnet is one of them there portmanteaus. The combo of words robot and network to create a name for a big collection of computer applications, networks, software that does things autonomously. A botnet. Sounds good in theory. Unless a botnet goes evil, then the botnet can turn computers into what those in the biz call zombies. Botnets are making a rise in the world of malware. By one count, 40% of the 800 million computers connected to the internet are bots behaving badly, sending spam, stealing information, and then infecting others. And they just creep right up on you, and you might not even notice it. To help us better understand the botnet, both good and evil, we've called up Joe Stewart, senior security researcher with SecureWorks, an information security firm. Hi, Joe.
Hi, Allison.
So I gave a really basic definition of a botnet. Will you flesh that out for us a bit?
Sure. Well, a botnet is a group of bots, which are just automated computer programs. And they're sometimes called zombies, as you mentioned, or some people call them drones. But the key thing about the botnet is that all of these bots are controlled by one individual or sometimes a group, and they act in a coordinated way. So they're able to carry out tasks that a single computer by itself couldn't do.
For example?
Well, see, botnets could be used for good or bad. So, for instance, you might look at the botnet that's run by Stanford. You know, they try to solve problems that could lead to cures for diseases. And there's one run by the SETI project where, you know, bots look for unusual signals in the data that are captured by SETI's radio telescopes.
So those are the good uses of botnets. But like many things, there are unintended consequences, and botnets can be used for evil. Can you give me an example?
So the kind of botnets that might be run by criminals are the ones that, you know, most people are talking about when they use the term botnet. So they might be talking about the Storm botnet, which is one that's been big in the news here. You know, it's gone back for several years. I looked at one called So Big. There's one in the news lately called Mega D. So there's lots of different botnets out there all doing different things.
All right, explain to our folks why Storm botnet is in the news for behaving badly.
Well, Storm just came on the scene last year, and it really just made a big impact in the amount of email it was generating. So Storm is designed to send spam, but it also sends links to itself so that it can infect more users. And
so it kind of feeds itself?
Yeah, it just had such a big email list and you know, trying to go out there and collect new users. And every time a new user would get infected, all the email addresses from that person's hard drive would then be used to send it out to more people. And so it grew really big, really fast.
You mentioned a couple of different botnets. I mean, are there just loads of them out there waiting to infect my computer?
Yeah, there actually are loads of them out there. There's just, you know, hundreds of them. And, you know, there's a few big ones. There's a lot of small ones. And they're all out there just to do, you know, one of just a few different things, basically.
Now, is there any way that I can figure out that my home computer has been commandeered by a botnet, has been brought into the botnet army and turned evil?
It's difficult. I mean, sometimes you might be able to tell, let's say if they're sending out a lot of spam, it might actually slow your computer down, and you may be a little more unresponsive than normal. But usually, I mean, you don't see any indication that tells you. I mean, they don't want you to know that you're infected because they want to stay on your computer as long as they can.
We have a question from coming out of our control room, wants to know if Macs are vulnerable.
Macs, they are vulnerable, but they're not as big of a target. So, I mean, anybody, you know, can write a program and run it on any operating system, whether it's, you know, Windows or Mac or Linux. And, you know, so they can certainly write bots for Mac, and you know, a few people have, but, you know, there's not as many Mac users out there. It's you know, mainly Windows users that are the target right now.
We're talking to Joe Stewart, who's a senior security researcher with SecureWorks, an information security firm. And we should point out that part of what your business is to fight these botnets. How does one do that?
Well, you know, the way that most people have to fight them is to, you know, on one hand, try to identify the users that are infected with them. So we try to, you know, detect the kind of traffic they're sending out on the network and try to identify anybody that's infected and get them cleaned. And on the other hand, it's trying to shut down their command and control points. So we try to identify, you know, where they're being controlled from and go to these ISPs and get those command points shut down.
Now, at this point, people who use botnets for malicious use, are they breaking laws? Which laws are they breaking if they are?
Usually they're breaking laws, at least in the U.S., but unfortunately a lot of these botnet owners are located in countries where it's either not against the law or the authorities, you know, don't really care about it that much.
Is there something that I can do personally to my computer? Is there some sort of botnet prophylactic? Is there any way I can keep my computer from getting infected?
Well, unfortunately, no. I mean, as long as there's people out there that want to, you know, send spam or steal money, they need botnets. And so you're never going to be completely safe. They're always going to try to find a way around your defenses. But, you know, you can reduce your risk of being infected, you know, if you do several things. So you might already have an antivirus scanner, right? But, you know, they're just not as effective as they used to be at catching these things early on. And that's because the criminals, they have antivirus too.
Mm-hmm.
So they're going to make sure their bot's not going to be detected before they even send it out. So you might, you know, not detect that you're infected, you know, for a week or a month later, and, you know, there's a good chance they might even disable your antivirus. So you've got to take additional steps. So you have to look at how this stuff gets on your computer in the first place, and it's one of two ways usually. Either they're going to try to trick you into running a program,
mm-hmm.
or they're going to get you, you know, automatically when you visit a website by taking advantage of weaknesses in your web browser where they can get something to automatically install.
All right. So the thing I can do personally is not to get tricked into clicking through to some website.
Exactly. So
okay.
you have to be suspicious of just about everything you receive. So even if it's from someone you know, because, you know, guess what? Your friend might be infected with a bot, and the bad guys might be using his or her address book to find new victims. You know, this is what Storm did. So if you get an email with an attachment that you didn't expect from anybody, you know, email them back first and ask them about it.
Good advice.
You know, and those for links.
Good advice. Joe Stewart is a senior security researcher for SecureWorks. Thanks, Joe.
You're welcome.
Joe Stewart's also my dad's name. It's kind of fun to just call him Joe there. Coming up on the Bryant Park Project, the big meat out, a day when vegetarians work to increase their numbers. But we'll hear from some folks from the other side, the editors of Meat Paper. It's coming up on the BPP. This is the Bryant Park Project from NPR News, online all the time at npr.org/Bryant Park. I'm Allison Stewart, and I am rolling solo this week, except for this one segment. All right, there's two segments, and I need company. I need help, frankly. Editor Tricia McKinney, she's in here to help me ramble.
Yes.
And demanding water, by the way. Here comes Dan Cashman. You had a little diva moment there.
I know, I did. I poured myself a cup of water.
No, this is the way it went. Pick the phone. Did Cashman take my water? If he did, he's in trouble. Get it in here.
That's right.
And then the phone went down.
I'm sorry,
man. I don't even pull that.
I'm never this organized. I poured myself a cup of water, and then it had gone missing. I have a cold, so there we go.
You did good, diva. You did good.
Go ahead. Thanks, baby. All right, so let's make this worth it. A court in Sicily has ruled that an accused mafioso will now serve house arrest instead of going to jail because he's too fat for jail.
Oh, no.
This guy apparently weighs 462 pounds, and he spent 6 months in prison in four different prisons, according to his lawyer. And guards at the first two prisons said it was too much work. They had to constantly help this guy get dressed and undressed and move around and go to the bathroom. And then other prison guards said there's no bed big enough for the guy. He couldn't get through the bathroom door, and that they wouldn't be able to help him if, for any reason, he had a medical emergency.
Now, I have to say something really inappropriate. Isn't prison food terrible, or is it really good in Italy like every other thing you go out to eat in Italy?
Ooh, that's a really good question. I haven't spent much time in Italian prison, so I can't really give you that kind of feedback. But, I mean, I don't think he had been there very long. I think he weighed a lot before he went to jail.
Gotcha.
Anyway, he's accused of, he was one of those guys rounded up last year in that big Salvatore Lo Piccolo bust in Sicily, so...
This one, back in the States, art buyers beware. Actually, it's an international art ring, I should say. Federal prosecutors are charging four American art dealers with participating in this international art fraud ring that allegedly sold thousands of fake Picassos, Dalis, and Chagall prints. Now, the prosecutors say the forgers, along with three Europeans, made more than $5 million selling the fake art. Now, this might have been a clue. They were selling it on eBay. Just saying. Go to Christie's if you're buying a Picasso. One dealer is accused of selling so much fake art that the other forgers warned her, you know, you better cut back. Two of the dealers are from Chicago. Prosecutors say one of them spoke in code as he discussed the fake art over the phone with his European contacts. Another dealer is accused of forging the artist's signature on the fake prints. These guys were really bold.
I'm just kind of amazed it's only $5 million. I mean, these things are, I guess...
Well, that's what they say. It's the $5 million they found.
That's true.
What's up next, Tricia?
Well, spring today has sprung.
Yes.
Actually, it apparently has started springing early. And while a lot of people might think that's a good thing, actually biologists are worrying. The Associated Press put out this really interesting story. They interviewed about 30 scientists who all kind of pointed to different anecdotal evidence that things are happening a little bit too early. Like, for example, the cherry trees in Washington, D.C. are about to bloom, and it's about a week early than the traditional start of the blooming season. There's a butterfly in California that wouldn't normally come out until mid-April. It's been fluttering around for about a week already. There's already pollen in the air. In Philadelphia, they've detected some pollen that you wouldn't even be able to measure until the end of next month. So this has had some biologists alarmed. They're saying, you know, with the codependence on animals and plants, like if there's a plant that blooms and an animal depends on it, maybe the food comes earlier than the animal would get the food, and that would affect the animal. Maybe birds are laying eggs too early, and so the chicks hatch too early. The insects that they eat aren't there yet. And so they're really pointing to, they're blaming global warming for this, and saying it could be an indicator of bad things to come. Sorry to bring everybody down.
That's all right. I'll bring them back up with Japan's new ambassador is anime, and the country's foreign minister has given this job to an anime cat.
Who else could do that job?
Exactly.
I mean, if you think about it.
Ambassador Doraemon, a cartoon robot cat who has traveled back in time from the 22nd century. Doraemon reports to, quote, convey to the people abroad what ordinary Japanese people think, our lifestyles, and what kind of future we want to build.
Well, he would know the future.
He would. He's been there. He can report back. He's got a couple quirks. Likes to eat red bean pancakes, apparently.
That's a selling point.
All right. Apparently, Astro Boy, another cartoon icon, was named last November as ambassador for overseas safety.
Can I tell you something?
Yes.
I knew the woman who did the voice for Astro Boy.
You did?
I did. Her name's Billy Lou Watt.
Well, hi, Billy.
Hi, Billy
Lou.
That's really apropos of nothing.
No, it's a brush with fame.
I'm so glad I had that water so that I could say that.
Right here in the Bryant Park Project. Editor Tricia McKinney. Thanks, Tricia.
I'm going to take a big gulp right now.
That's The Ramble. You can find these links to these stories on our website, npr.org/Bryant Park. Go order Pashman around some more. On this first day of spring, one animal rights group is urging people to use the occasion of a fresh start, a brand new season, to give up eating meat. The group is called FARM, and the occasion is called the Great American Meat Out. I'm calling it GAMO. So let's leave aside for a moment the politics of eating meat and the economics of meat eating, and let's just get practical. If you want to give up meat, what's the best way to do it without compromising nutrition and that need to feed on flesh? Someone going through this right now is Rod Dreher, a columnist with the Dallas Morning News. So, Rod, you know, your reasons for giving up meat are religious. Can you explain?
Yeah, I'm a convert to Eastern Orthodox Christianity, and we Eastern Orthodox Christians are going through our Lent now. It started a lot later than Western Lent, and the Orthodox Lent is a lot more austere than the Catholic Lent in that we give up all meat and all dairy for the full duration. So right now I'm eating essentially a vegan diet.
How long have you been at this?
About 2 weeks, and we'll continue through April 27th.
What's been toughest so far down in Texas?
I do live in Texas. Giving up ribs and my daily dose of Chipotle has been the toughest thing. But, you know, I think it's hard mostly because we've all gotten used to the expectation that our meals just have to have meat or we're missing out. And in fact, the first few days, you know, I sort of felt cheated or maybe even a little bit hungry because I wasn't able to eat meat. But I found that this is mostly psychological, that as long as you have protein in some form, whether it's beans or tofu, you know, and you get used to it, it's really, you don't feel like you're missing much at all.
You lead me to my next question. I wondered if you noticed a change in your attitude towards meat now that you've been meat-free for almost half a month.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. You know, I read a lot of Michael Pollan, and I am not only a Christian, but I'm a conservative, and a crunchy conservative. I wrote the book on crunchy cons, and I find that I don't need meat as much. I tell my wife that when Lent is over, I don't want to go back to eating as much meat. I am an enthusiastic carnivore, but I find that I really, having gone without meat for only 2 weeks and having the next month ahead of me, I don't really need it as much as I thought I did, and I want to eat better and eat better meat, meat that's not been factory farmed once we get out of Lent. And because I know I can do with a lot less meat, I can afford the more expensive pasture-raised meat.
Now, had you ever contemplated giving up meat before this, but for other reasons than religion?
No, not really. I mean, when I read this great book by Matthew Scully, who's a former Bush speechwriter, he wrote a book called Dominion about animal welfare, and he is a vegetarian. He really challenged my conservative ideas and ideology about meat eating by talking about the way we treat animals. And as a conservative, that really got to me and spoke to me. But as an enthusiastic carnivore, I quickly forgot about his message and his moral message once confronted with the Chipotle burrito.
One of the big issues here for you is the reason you're doing this is because of your faith. What religious lessons are you learning from giving up meat?
Well, I tell you, the reason that we have Lent, such an austere Lent, is to remind us that, you know, we aren't slaves to our appetite, that we should subordinate our material needs and our physical appetites to higher spiritual principles. And Lent is a time to refocus on that and to realize that we are more than just what we eat. And I'm also thinking a whole lot about the way we relate to the material world in general as Christians, that it's not just there for our use, to use and abuse as we see fit, but that it has to be ordered rightly, and our relationship to the material world has to be ordered rightly. Lent and giving up meat and giving up dairy, too, is a time to refocus on what's really important.
But nuts and bolts, how did you handle those initial meat cravings?
Hot sauce. Lots of hot sauce. I've gone through so much sambal sauce. And I tell you, you know, one thing that I think discourages people from trying vegetarian eating is we think that the food is going to be bland. But if you expose yourself to food cultures of people who know how to do great things without meat, Middle Eastern food culture, Asian and Indian, you can eat really well without having meat in the diet and have lots of hot sauce, too, to cover the tofu.
Rod Dreher is a columnist with the Dallas Morning News. He's blogging about his new meat-free life, and you can find a link to that on our website at npr.org/Bryant Park. Good luck, Rod.
Thanks a lot.
Now, from one end of the meat spectrum to the other, if you're interested in all things meat, you might want to subscribe to a magazine called Meat Paper. The subject matter includes meat art, animal slaughter, responsible meat consumption, and it's edited by two former vegetarians. And a little while ago, we spoke to one of them. Amy Standen is also a reporter for Quest, a science and environment show on public radio's KQED. Here's part of that interview. So, a former vegetarian editing a magazine about meat.
About meat.
How does that leave happen?
Well, what we like to say is vegetarianism is just another response to meat. So Meat Paper is a magazine that is not just for meat eaters. It's for meat shunners as well. And anyone who has a curiosity about meat. And what we found is that meat is just a great symbol for so many of the big questions we all deal with. It's a great subject for artists. It has great cultural significance. And as vegetarians, former vegetarians, I should say, it's something that Sasha Wozanski and I have both thought a lot about over the years.
You've coined this term Fleischgeist. What exactly does that mean? I'm assuming it's a take on Zeitgeist.
Yes, it is. So Fleischgeist is the spirit of meat, and what we're referring to is this explosion of interest in meat that we have seen over the last few years. It's part of the zeitgeist. Is this interest in meat, where it comes from, how the animals are treated before they become meat, whether or not we as human beings should be eating meat at all, what meat suggests about our own mortality, about the ethical questions we all, or many of us, struggle with. It's this just amazing resurgence of interest in this particular kind of food.
It's interesting that meat is something that people will take a moral stand about. You don't really
Yes.
hear people take a moral stand about cheese.
No.
About bread.
Vegetables, no. We could make a magazine about carrots, but I think it would be a much more limited venue for us, or much more limited subject. Meat is really troubling. I mean, it's less troubling, I think, when you get it at the grocery store wrapped in cellophane. That's the meat we all are sort of accustomed to dealing with. There's a certain kind of cognitive suspension that we all go through when we buy meat, or many of us do. I think most people don't really want to know a whole lot about where their meat comes from, what the kind of life the animal lived, those kinds of things. Once you start getting involved in, or, you know, curious about those kinds of questions and finding out more, you are confronted with a lot of questions. And, you know, many of those are moral questions, the questions, of course, that vegetarians pose to us and decide not to eat meat at all. But many of them are philosophical questions. you know, what's the difference between our own meat and animal meat? Where do we sort of draw the line about certain animals that we will eat and certain animals that we won't eat? Why do we eat cows and not horses? Yet in other cultures, people do eat horses.
All right. I'm going to take you to task for the one thing that I'm taking off my journalist hat that bothers me when I saw it. And it's not, I used to be vegetarian. I'm not anymore. But when I saw the various meat art, all I could think to myself was there are families who need to be fed. And here we see
And here is a woman covered in flank steak.
Yeah, but there's something about that that really bothered me.
I think that's a completely legitimate response to it. I mean, to tell the truth, I have the same response when I see artists who, you know, cover entire buildings in cellophane or something. You know, obviously people don't eat cellophane, but I think, oh my God, what a waste of plastic, all the petroleum. I mean, I think there is so much in art, especially contemporary big art, that is, you could say, wasteful of resources. And I think that makes complete sense as a response to some of the artists that we've shown who, you know, make huge installation projects full of meat that then rots. And isn't that a waste of an animal's life?
One of the things that you discuss in the magazine is responsible meat eating. Obviously, vegetarians and vegans would say, okay, that's a contradiction in terms. Can you explain what you mean when you talk about responsible meat consumption?
You know, a chef like Chris Cosentino, who's a chef here in San Francisco at a restaurant called Encanto, what he would say is responsible meat eating is eating an animal who has led a life that, you know, did not involve too much confinement, an animal that was treated well, an animal that was slaughtered humanely, which, again, a lot of people would say is an oxymoron, but there are different ways of slaughtering animals. Some of which are better than others. And also, I think the most important thing, it's a respect for the animal that has you as the diner eating all parts of the animal. In other words, not just going for the T-bone or the, you know, but eating the heart, eating the liver, eating the brain, eating, you know, any part of the animal that is safe to eat, which is most of the animal. That's called the whole animal ethic. And this is part of the Fleischgeist. You're seeing chefs all over the country serving food that has not been on American plates since the 1950s.
Amy, the question, which is obvious, but I wanted to wait till the end to ask you, is you were a vegetarian. What happened?
To tell the truth, I'm always teetering on the edge. And I very well may go back to being a vegetarian one of these days.
That was Amy Standen of Meat Paper. Okay, so here at the BPP, we have a motto. Give us your tired, your hungry, your wry and witty cartoons that for some reason the New Yorker has chosen not to run. We take them in. We have room. Friend of the BPP, cartoonist Matthew Diffie, editor of the book The Rejection Collection, is here for his regular visit to make us laugh and give us a little take that fancy pants New Yorker attitude. Hi,
exactly.
Matthew.
Who'd you bring
with you today?
This is Zachary Cannon.
Hey, Zachary.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. Zachary's
radio
got the radio
voice.
Pipes.
Yeah.
Well,
listen
I was
to
called
that.
Ma'am on the phone yesterday.
All right, so the subject of today's cartoons fit in well with this whole block, food and cattle. For our first-time listeners, this is the way it goes. We have an audio rendition of your cartoons so that this whole bit can actually work on the radio. Right. But before we play it, anything we should know about your cartoon, Matthew? Do you want to, your state of mind when you drew it, do you want to set it up a little bit?
Probably not.
Okay.
I don't know. You'll probably get letters. So I apologize for that. But
all right.
Yeah, maybe we should just listen to it first.
We're multimedia. We'll get emails.
Oh, emails,
just
yeah.
So you know. The BPP Players audio reenactment of Matthew Diffie's rejected New Yorker cartoon.
A large man and a large woman are sitting at a cafe table holding menus. A pigtailed waitress holds a pen to her order pad. The large woman studies her menu as the large man says, "We'll have the breakfast all day." The waitress does not look up.
Nice. I wondered what the adjective would be. Large, I guess, is the politically correct term.
Yeah, these people are of a certain size, shall we say,
yes,
who are sitting at this table. Could you explain the misunderstanding?
Well, I think that they saw on the, you know, outside that breakfast is served all day, and they they thought that was a temporal term, and they were going to have breakfast all day long.
So the faces are pretty priceless in this. What is the waitress thinking? What are the patrons thinking?
Yeah, I don't know if the waitress is she's probably just trying not to laugh, I would think, trying desperately not to, giggle. And the patrons are thinking nothing, out of the ordinary. They're just ordering breakfast. They found their restaurant where they can have breakfast all day.
Now, is this just, frankly, a fat joke?
It is. And for that, I apologize.
From a tall, skinny Texan making the fat jokes.
Yeah, exactly. And that's probably why it didn't get bought at the New Yorker magazine.
Have you ever seen anything like this actually happen, or was this a figment of your skinny imagination?
My skinny imagination. I've never seen anything. I feel bad all of a sudden. I shouldn't have done this. I'm sorry, everyone. America.
Should I rip it?
Yes, just tear that one.
All right, that's a mean cartoon.
Mean. Fact.
All right, Zach, you're up next. Let's hear the audio version of yours. No, Zach's doing a rap song?
Interesting cartoon.
Two men in work clothes and ball caps are ushering a herd of cows through a small opening into the side of a building. Around the corner, the viewer sees another building with smokestacks and a gangplank. One man is propping the sliding steel door open while the other man is herding the cows through. The first man says, "It's gotten a lot harder since they started wearing lipstick." The cows' faces are not visible.
Why don't I get to see the cows wearing lipstick, Zach?
I think it would be harder for the viewer also to imagine them being ushered into the slaughterhouse.
It's funnier not seeing them.
Yeah.
Also, we can't...
It's really hard to draw a cow's lips. they don't have lips, really.
We passed this one around the office, and we were wondering if you were touching on the you can't put lipstick on a pig.
No, I just thought it would be, it's harder to put a human face on the cow, like an actual
also,
human
makeup. Also, you can't
makeup.
Use red.
That's
pink,
true. Yeah, it would just look like they had really nice lips.
You could do a little gloss.
Maybe.
Did you get any feedback on why this didn't make it, Zach?
the New Yorker's actually passed on all of my Slaughterhouse cartoons so far.
All right, note to self. Slaughter, maybe not funny to the New Yorker.
But maybe that could be a second
book. I'm just
going
to keep trying, because this one's pretty good.
What's the crux of the joke for you, Zach? Help me out.
Oh, just that it's difficult to kill the cow when it looks like a human.
That when it looks purdy?
Yeah, when it's a beautiful cow.
Yeah. Matthew Diffie and Zachary Cannon, your official name. Thank you for coming in and sharing your New Yorker rejected cartoons. Of course, we'll let you see them on our website as well. Oh, here's the rap music. Coming up, we'll catch up on all the headlines, and fans of The Man Show, Adam Carolla has a whole movie, 95 minutes worth. Is it worth your time? We'll tell you on the BPP. Hey, thank you for spending part of your Thursday with us here at the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. We are on digital FM, Sirius Satellite Radio, and online at npr.org/Bryant Park. I'm Allison Stewart. Hey, everybody. Coming up, we know tomorrow starts a long weekend for a lot of people, which means a Friday matinee could be in your future. Our movie reviewer, Daniel Holloway, will be here in just a minute to help guide us through. But first, let's get some news headlines.
This is NPR.
Allison, thanks, and good morning, everyone. Palestinian officials say Israeli troops killed a Palestinian farmer in Gaza today. In a separate incident, two Palestinian militants were killed in an explosion. The Israeli army says it was not involved. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports.
Palestinian medical officials said the 65-year-old farmer was killed while he was riding on a donkey in his field near the central Gaza town of Khan Yunis. An Israeli army spokesman said the army is investigating. In a separate incident, two Hamas gunmen were killed in an explosion at a training camp in Gaza City. Hamas said they died after an Israeli airstrike, but an army spokesman said the army was not involved. He said the men apparently died when ammunition at the base exploded. Egyptian officials are continuing to mediate a ceasefire between Israel and Hamas, although the level of violence has already dropped sharply in recent days. Israel also imposed a complete closure on the West Bank and Gaza for a Jewish holiday, which begins tonight.
That was NPR's Linda Gradstein. Democratic presidential contender Hillary Clinton failed to nudge Michigan lawmakers Wednesday into holding a do-over primary. The National Democratic Party stripped Michigan of its convention delegates for holding this year's vote too early. Senator Clinton backs a plan for a new state-run vote on June 3rd. That plan will likely get its last chance today before lawmakers take their spring recess. Flooding across much of the central United States has been blamed for at least 13 deaths and forced the evacuation of hundreds of people. NPR's Jason Bobian reports from Kansas City.
Heavy rains dumped as much as a foot of water in parts of the Midwest, flooding roadways and stranding motorists. Flash flood warnings have been issued from Texas up to Illinois and east as far as Pennsylvania. In parts of eastern Missouri, several rivers rose 10 to 15 feet above flood stage. Rising waters led to evacuations in low-lying areas throughout the region. In Texas, rescue workers continued to search for a boy swept away by a swollen creek east of Dallas. In Missouri, emergency personnel have been looking for a man reportedly swept away there. As the storm system slowly moves east, waters in many rivers are expected to continue to rise. The Ohio River in Cincinnati is projected to crest at almost 2 feet above flood stage on Friday.
That was NPR's Jason Bobian. And Starbucks is promising to get its mojo back with a rapid return to its roots. It's all about the coffee. That's what Starbucks chief Howard Schultz told workers and shareholders at the chain's annual meeting in Seattle yesterday. Back in February, Starbucks announced it would slash 600 jobs and close 100 underperforming stores in the United States. Now Schultz says Starbucks will install new espresso machines, introduce a new coffee blend, and offer its card customers free refills on drip coffee and free syrups in specialty drinks. That's the news for now. It's always online at NPR.org.
This is NPR.
Thanks, Laura.
Thank you.
The guys who brought you Superbad are back. There's a movie that will likely make Lou Dobbs go ballistic. And a boxing movie starring a cable TV and radio star. What to do, what to do? Let's ask Daniel Holloway, BPP movie guru and critic for Metro Newspaper. Hi, Daniel. Good morning.
Hey, Allison.
All right, we're going to start with Drill Bit Taylor, about a drifter of a guy who convinces some loser kids that he can be their own personal bodyguard. The film, if you look at it on the paper, Dan, it's got this pedigree that's kind of great. Seth Rogen of Superbad, one of the screenwriters. Judd Apatow of Knocked Up is a producer. John Hughes of 80s movies fame's involved. Owen Wilson stars. So does hilarity ensue?
Well, it's, you mentioned that Seth Rogen also co-wrote Superbad, and of course Apatow produced that also. Think of this movie as a prequel to Superbad with a homeless bodyguard thrown into it. you have your overweight, loud kid, your shy, skinny, unassuming kid, and then you have basically your McLovin character, your scrawny, freak, weirdo friend, and they have adventures, and instead of finishing high school, they're beginning high school.
So they're younger. They're sort of 14, 15?
Yeah, they're freshmen.
All right. Well, let's take a listen to Owen Wilson. He's the homeless wannabe bodyguard to these kids, trying to describe to the kids what he's really all about.
I'm Drillbit Taylor. U.S. Army Ranger, Black Ops operative, decorated marksman, improvised weapons expert.
Are you still in the military?
I was discharged. Unauthorized heroism. They call it an army of one in the ads, but...
Okay, that was funny.
Yeah.
As a bodyguard, I protected 3 vice presidents. Bobby Brown, Sylvester Stallone. Not as tough as he looks. So what's the story? Who do you guys need protection from?
It should be easy for you. Just a high school bully.
Yeah. Run into a few of those in my life. What'd you do to provoke him?
He's fat and he's a dork and I'm awesome.
Oh, shut up, Lee.
By awesome, do you mean scared, skinny, and lonely?
Yeah.
I've been all 3 of those things at the same time in my life. I have to tell you, I'm sort of feeling with these kids. I want my own bodyguard. Funny or no? Is this for kids that age?
It's for a little bit younger than Superbad. It's still pretty raunchy, but it feels a little younger. It's not as funny as Superbad or Knocked Up. Owen Wilson is a welcome presence in any movie, as far as I'm concerned. The problem with him is that he does too many movies that he probably shouldn't. This is kind of on the fence between good, and he's definitely done worse things. But, he helps the film out a lot. The kids are cute and funny, and there are some good, dirty jokes in it. So it's like Superbad light, I'd say.
If you're watching this movie, we all know that Owen Wilson went through a really bad personal patch. Tabloids went running with it, suggesting that he tried to commit suicide. seeing him on screen doing this funny guy role, was that in your mind at all as you were watching, or?
A little bit. You know, you're just happy to see him back and doing the work and, you know, and seeming to have fun with it. He always seems, I think that was what was shocking for everybody when that stuff started coming out, is because he always seems like a guy who's having fun, which is a very, very cliched thing to say, you know, oh, you look like you had so much fun making this movie. Right. Well, it's work. But yeah, he's a welcome presence in any film, and it's good to have him back working.
The next movie we want to talk about is called Under the Same Moon. This is the movie I said that will make Lou Dobbs' eyes roll back in his head. It's the story of a boy crossing the border into the United States from Mexico to find his illegal immigrant mother. We decided to play a little bit of the trailer so you can get an overview of the film. So let's listen to this.
My mom says, when I miss her, I should look at the moon because she'll be looking at it too. She's been working in America for 4 years. So she can bring me there soon.
Carlitos?
Mommy! But when my grandma died, I couldn't wait anymore.
Are you ready?
Yeah.
I don't know about this.
I can do it.
You have to be quiet, Carlitos.
Welcome to the United States of America.
Get out of the car, please.
I'm sorry, is there a problem?
Open the trunk.
Okay, is this a tearjerker?
It's a tearjerker. It's also in Spanish. That trailer is really deceptive. Like,
the movie's in Spanish.
Yeah, 98% of the film is in Spanish.
So they took every English part of the movie and put it in the trailer.
And actually, I think his monologue at the beginning is something that he says in the film in Spanish that they have the actor rereading. Mm-hmm. It's funny, the woman's voice you actually hear there is America Ferrera from Ugly Betty, who has a small part in the film playing an American Chicano who comes to Mexico, but she's only in basically that one scene, and that's the extent of the English that we get in the film. Yeah, it's a tearjerker. There's some, as you can tell, there's some really maudlin music involved. But the kid is adorable. He's probably like, his name is Adrian Alonso, and he's got to be like the most adorable kid actor in North America. I mean, he's great. And
is it a political movie at all?
Political in the sense that there's definitely a message. At one point, you know, one character turns to the little boy because he's complaining because his mother has gone to Los Angeles and has been gone for 4 years to send money back so that he can have things like, you know, clothing and schooling. And he's mad at his mother. He ends up, the premise of the movie is through a series of events, he has to cross the border and go to L.A. and try to find her alone at 9 years old. And he's traveling with someone and expresses anger at his mother. And the guy's like, listen, you know, what part of this did you enjoy? Picking tomatoes, running from the INS. Nobody does this unless they have a good reason to do it. And that is the message of the movie, very much, is showing us that the people who cross the border illegally are people, and that they have extraordinary reasons for doing so, because it is not a fun thing to do, as Lou Dobbs seems to think it is.
It's about survival. Right. Would you call this a must-see, could-see, don't want to see?
You know, it's difficult when you find films whose politics you agree with, but aren't quite up to snuff. I wouldn't say it's a bad movie. Again, the kid is adorable. There are some good performances in it, but it is quite maudlin at times.
Okay, that is called Under the Same Moon. We're going to move on to some funny stuff.
Yeah.
This one is called The Grand, and it's described as an improvised comedy about poker. So the dialogue is all improv?
Yeah, it's done in the style of the Christopher Guest movies, although Christopher Guest is not involved, like Waiting for Guffman, Best in Show, Mighty Wind. And what it is, it's a poker tournament in Vegas. And what I believe the background of the film is that director Zach Penn actually had his characters play through this the final poker table to see who the last two players would win. So in reality, the character who wins the poker tournament is the actor who won a poker tournament that they shot.
That's pretty cool. I'm going to ask you about Zach Penn in a minute, but I want to talk about the cast a little bit. Woody Harrelson, Saturday Night Live's Chris Parnell. And in this scene, it's a brother and sister poker team played by David Cross and Cheryl Hines from Curb Your Enthusiasm. She's very funny. Here they are explaining their poker skills.
At this point in your careers, you're top players. And you basically never have that moment where you look at your cards and you go, hey, what is this thing? What is this card? What am I looking at?
I don't understand the question. You mean like what we think we're going to flop with our
No, like, actually, the cards themselves. I mean, you know, with the Werby method, of course, I have my remedial exercises in the flashcards where people get to practice. They get to practice the cards and memorize them. But I'm guessing that at this point in your careers, you never really have that moment where you go, hey, is that a three or a four? Is that a spades? Is that a club? You sort of, is it like a sixth sense that you got now going? How does it work?
Well, no, it's actually one of the five senses, which is vision, because I know how to read numbers, and my brain can distinguish between shapes.
That's so funny. So that's all improvised.
Yeah, yeah. I believe it's done in the same way as those guest movies where there's a rough sketch of where the plot will go. And
does it wander off, though? Or, I mean, that one bit is particularly funny. Do you have to wait for the funny through periods
there
not
are definitely
so funny?
There are definitely times when you have to wait for the funny. The problem with this film is that, unlike those guest films or unlike Spinal Tap or other, you know, improvised films that we've seen, those guest films, the characters feel like real characters in a film. They feel like characters in life. No matter how extreme their behavior may be, they still feel like real characters. These characters at times feel like characters in a sketch. And they at times feel like characters in different sketches. That one sports, Cross and Cheryl Hines are pros and they're really good. But the fella who plays the poker announcer who's interviewing them, his character is just annoying and seems to belong in this completely different movie where he's doing like weird mock commercials with crazy graphics, and it's just too strange of a change of pace. But,
and this really isn't Zach Penn's world. He's done other films like X-Men, right?
Yeah. Oh, no, no, no. Wait, no.
The director? Of this film?
Singer. Bryan Singer did X-Men,
oh,
correct?
One of them. Or wrote one of them. He's involved with X-Men
somehow. Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
No, this is definitely like a change of pace for Penn, and it doesn't, I'm not quite sure that it works.
Okay. Finally, The Hammer. It's a boxing movie. I think it looks better than it should be. I went through a lot of the trailers and I was, well, I shouldn't say that. Let's say it looks familiar. And it stars Adam Carolla of The Man Show. What's the basic story?
Okay. Here's the story. You got older, working-class Italian boxer past his physical peak. He gets involved in a scheme plotted by boxing's overlords, but then he comes in and he exceeds all expectations.
I'm running up the stairs to the Philadelphia Library.
No, you're in Los Angeles. You live in a faceless apartment complex in Los Angeles.
I'm not Rocky Balboa.
You are not Rocky Balboa. You
okay,
are
what's
Jerry,
the character's name?
Jerry Farrow.
Okay.
Carpenter. Sort of homeless. He's played by Adam Carolla of The Man Show and Loveline fame.
Yes.
Yes.
Well, let's take a listen to Adam playing this character, this sort of 40-year-old, not really in shape guy who's going to try to box. He's talking to one of the other boxers at the gym.
Hey, Jerry.
What's going on, Jerry?
I'm entering my first tournament.
Fantastic. You've been boxing for like 4 weeks. You think that's a good plan?
Oh, I'm ready for this one. It's the gay games.
Yeah, but Jeff, you're not gay.
No, no, but they don't check. That's the beauty of it.
They don't check.
I figure I'll get a little competitive experience, you know? Kick a little ass.
I don't know. I've seen some of those guys. They're pretty ripped.
Come on. You think I'm going to lose to a guy who enters the ring to Barbara Streisand?
I think he'd lose to Barbara Streisand.
Come on. I've learned from the best.
Do you have to like Adam Carolla to like this movie?
A little bit, yeah. And I kind of like him a little bit. Not, I mean, I wasn't thrilled with The Man Show, but I find him funny sometimes, and I find this movie funny sometimes. The plot is basically Rocky, you know, and that's weird. But turning Rocky into a romantic comedy isn't the worst idea in the world. And there's, you know, some subtle things about this film. The weirdest thing is that Adam Carolla does not look like Sylvester Stallone at any point in his life. He doesn't even look like, I mean, I may as well be in the film. You know, he doesn't take his shirt off at all throughout the movie. You know, it's a little difficult to believe that he can beat up the people he beats up.
All right, that one's called The Hammer. Daniel Holloway is film critic for Metro and helps us out on Fridays. Thanks, Dan.
Thank you.
Nice to see you.
Good to see you.
Let's take a quick check of our blog, our editor, Laura Conaway, doubling as newscaster
today. Good morning.
Today.
How are you?
I'm doing okay. I don't want to take up too much of your time because I know you're busy. What do you got in the blog?
We got a couple things. One is, you know, today is the first day of spring, right?
Yes.
And there's this sort of an old wives' tale, it turns out, that you can turn an egg, you can stand an egg on end at the exact moment of the equinox. Summer Ash, our in-house astrophysicist, says that's not true, and you can read all about it. It's not true. Apparently you can stand an egg on end anytime you want to.
Oh.
It's really just a question of gravity. Check it out. We're getting smarter all the time.
All right. Anything else I should know about?
Yeah. Angela Ellis is starting a series for us on famous firsts. Basically, people who are the first to do something. Could be a big thing. Could be an obscure thing. And she's opened a thread for it because there are so many possible famous firsts that she's interested in what BPP listeners are looking at and what they're finding for, you know, the first person to balance an egg on end on the equinox, for instance.
Well, there you go.
Also, there's an amazing thread about video producer Wynn's dog, Cosby.
Cosman.
He swallowed a Brillo pad. And all is well, but it
the
turns
dog,
out...
The dog, not Wynn,
yeah,
by the way.
The dog swallowed a Brillo pad. All is well. Nature worked its course. But you guys had a lot of amazing things that your animals had swallowed, like 2 meters of blue ribbon, part of a couch. Check it out. It's really... If you have a dog or cat, you'll get it.
Bill's dog, Billy the Bowser, when he was a kid, ladies' underpants.
It's a big one for him.
He apparently worked it out.
That's what they do.
I'm not going into the details at this hour.
Just like Mama said.
Laura Conaway, our web editor. Thanks, Laura.
Thank you.
That does it for another hour of the Bryant Park Project. We are always online at npr.org/Bryant Park. I'm Allison Stewart. Thanks so much for being with us. This is the BPP from NPR News.